This is a locally made exploration into positive solutions to some of today's ecological challenges for all of us working to create a healthier future for our communities and for the world you live in.
Thanks for listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. My name is Teresa Wilkie. We're glad you've tuned in to Eco Radio KC. On today's program, Dave Bennett Freeling brings us a show about photons in food, light in our cells, with his guest Garrett Sullivan. Great information. Stay tuned. But first, the environmental news for the week of 9/9. Democracy Now! Reports that Trump administration's former top official who oversaw oil and gas drilling on federal lands, Joe Balash, has stepped down as the Interior Department's Assistant Secretary for Lands and Mineral Management and almost immediately confirmed he's joining the Papua New Guinea-based company Oil Search as a senior vice president. Oil Search is seeking to expand its oil extraction operations in remote parts of northern Alaska. 10 2020 hopefuls for president took to the stage in New York City last week for a climate town hall hosted by CNN. The candidates discussed their climate plans, the fossil fuel industry, the Green New Deal, fracking, carbon neutrality, and more. Senator Elizabeth Warren was questioned whether, as president, she would mandate the type of light bulbs Americans use. Warren's response was not about light bulbs, but rather to the point that 70% of the carbon that we're throwing into the air comes from three industries: buildings, electric power, and oil, and she recommended we set our targets for carbon reduction and say no more. Bernie Sanders pledged to reject nuclear energy and invest in wind, solar, and geothermal instead. Starting next year, Denmark will become the first country to ban PFAS chemicals from food packaging. The so-called forever chemicals are linked to cancer, high cholesterol, and decreased fertility, and they do not break down in the environment. Germany announced its plans to ban glyphosate by the end of 2023. The chemical pesticide is found in the popular Roundup weed killer. It's manufactured by Monsanto, and it has been found by the World Health Organization to lead to cancer. It has also been found to wipe out insect populations crucial for ecosystems and pollination of food crops. KSN News reports the Kansas State Fair is going green. It will be powered entirely by Kansas wind. State Fair officials partnered with Westar Energy, KCP&L, and Enel Green Power. They will be retiring renewable energy credits equal to the amount of electricity expected to be used at the fair. Kansas has become one of the biggest wind energy states in the country. The wind farm providing the wind energy, Diamond Vista, is about 60 miles outside the state fair. EcoWatch reports a group of beekeepers joined forces against Trump's U.S. EPA by filing a lawsuit over the EPA's move to put a powerful insecticide, sulfoxaflor, back on the market. The lawsuit charges that the EPA's approval of sulfoxaflor was illegal as it put industry interests ahead of the health of pollinators and ignored the available science. Kansas News Service reports some researchers think Kansas would be a good place to pump CO2 gas underground. With funding from the U.S. Department of Energy's Carbon Safe Program, researchers from the Kansas Geological Survey, environmental policy groups, lawyers, and oil and gas companies spent the last 3 years investigating the feasibility of carbon capture and storage in Kansas. The project would work like this. First, capture the CO2 straight from the exhaust pipes of the power plant. Then compress the gas into a liquid, then put it in a pipeline and send it to southwestern Kansas, where it would be pumped deep into the ground in some cases, and in other cases it could be used for something called enhanced oil recovery. That means injecting CO2 into the ground on one side of a fossil fuel deposit to push hard-to-reach oil and gas toward the well on the other side. Citizens Climate Lobby reports United States Representative Emanuel Cleaver, a former mayor of Kansas City, has become the 60th co-sponsor of the major bipartisan climate bill in Congress, the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act, H.R. 763, now in the House of Representatives. This groundbreaking climate bill, if passed, will implement a carbon pricing system with a 100% dividend return to households. H.R. 763 could rapidly reduce United States carbon emissions and and create over 2 million jobs. The policy puts a fee on production of fossil fuels like coal, oil, and gas. The money collected from the carbon fee is allocated in equal shares every month to the American people to spend as they see fit. Now, our show.
This is Dave Bennett Freeling here. You know, I'm a biology teacher by day, and when I teach about light, I've thus far shown kids what I know about light energy and how it reflects on most things, as the colors that we see, like a red apple is reflecting red light energy, and how light energy is also caught up by green plants during photosynthesis. Recently, discussing this with our guest Garrett Sullivan, I learned that there are many other ways that sunlight affects us, our cells, and our environment. And so I'm here with Dr. Garrett Sullivan. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Dr. Sullivan is a medical doctor, researcher, and educator with degrees in mathematics, biology, medicine, and is fellowship trained in systems biology, bioinformatics, orthomolecular medicine, integrative medicine, and he's participated in a Master of Science in Clinical Research curriculum. And this is a development program for physicians interested in incorporating research into their careers. He's also fortunate to have had the opportunity to spend some time working with the International Institute of Biophysics in Neuss, Germany. And he's participated with multiple clinical trials and continues activity as principal investigator with the FDA on bringing to clinical practice a fiber optic intravenous direct light delivery device for a number of clinical conditions. We welcome him to the show and look forward to what he can shed some light on for us. What's a biophoton?
Okay, so a photon in general is just the name given to a packet of light in physics terms. A biophoton is one that's specific to biological organisms or living things. And it's become clear that to maintain oneself or a thing as a living system, the system itself has to be energized, so to speak, by a photons, or what it takes to maintain their status as a activated system with energy stored in the structure that then makes all metabolism possible for them.
So biophotons keep life rolling inside of living things, basically.
It basically maintains the sustainability of a living system and is absolutely required.
All right. So sustainability is something we're gonna get into and talk about today. It's something with huge implications on all kinds of different things. It's been blowing my mind because it's all new ways of thinking about things. It's kind of changing the model by which we think about living things and light energy in the first place. And so it's going to be big topics. Prepare to think big and think differently today. This topic of light energy and how it affects us, how did you first get into this? What was your initial kind of dawning of the interest in this?
Okay, so coming out of college, I had a foundation in math, but I always kind of wanted to be a map maker, right? But political geography was kind of worked out for the most part, at least on our planet. Some of the final frontiers of map making is model making, basically. And biology is kind of one of those areas we still don't have a firm handle on. I mean, if you read any text of biology, there's not a firm consensus of what life actually is. So I ended up getting a degree in biology as well. Was working towards biophysics as a graduate degree. But I figured if I'm going to play around with the physics of life, I might as well just go into medicine and play around with the human condition, being that I thought that was probably the highest order of life on our planet to work with. So I went to medical school, and I'll have to admit I was a little bit surprised that they left the fundamental forces out of the discussion. They just weren't brought up in how we considered anything happening.
So not much physics brought up, or the
That's
things
right.
that are driving these chemical processes that make us tick.
Well, if you read it even just about quantum mechanics and some of the nature of chemistry and biochemistry, you can basically describe everything by the interaction of light and electrons and how those course through the system. So again, that wasn't brought up. So after medical school, I kind of had to resituate what I had learned in medical school on a more foundational basis. So I just turned to what we can actually measure, what we have measurements for, what we can verify that is in motion. Because there was so much that was presented based on older models of our understanding of the workings of biological things in general. You just didn't capture the sophistication that can be shown to occur in how our bodies work. So there's a lot of things that were just skipped right over in the textbooks and just given really simple explanations for how that happened. But in reality, the whole system is so much more sophisticated, and I had to kind of search from that point forward to how to bring in what I knew was most foundational to supporting somebody if they came in to see me as a medical provider for them. You know, quantum mechanics still to this day is considered the most reliable way to describe nature. And again, if it's not even brought up in how supporting another human is in medical school, there's a problem there.
You're missing something. You're missing the foundation. Yeah.
And we just need to bring that into our educational model so that people can appreciate this at a much deeper level.
It kind of gets to this. There's this divide in a lot of schools in academia, I guess, but even at the high school level, I've even seen it in middle schools where the chemistry and physics teachers make fun of the biology teachers because we're dealing with this kind of messy, rough, really unpredictable science that we don't understand completely. Yeah. And they're like, "Well, we understand everything. We're getting to the roots of how things really work, and you guys are just goofing around."
Well, so like the major model we've used for our medical systems and our medical care for individuals is still stuck in the biochemical understanding of things. And even if you go to your local college, it's still hard to find an integrative biophysics program to even, or course to even take, just because it's not organized in such a way that it's easy to teach. And again, things are changing. And even when I worked at the University of Kansas Medical Center, I've been working on a seminar series ultimately that we were going to deliver as a elective for the PhD and MD students over there that they could take just to kind of open their minds to some of these things. So it's exciting work. And in other universities around the world, this is taking shape, and there are curriculums that are becoming accessible to more people interested.
So one of the first things I wonder about it when you talk about these practical applications is what sort of device, what tools are used to understand biophotons and the emissions or giving off photons or even collecting photons. What do you use to see that or measure that?
Well, this has been studied for a long time. I mean, the first person to really get into the research of it was in the 20s, 1920s, and he just used other biological organisms. So, like, you can orient roots of, like, onions. That was one of his go-to organisms to study, but without actually touching the organisms together, something was being emitted from one root to influence the other root.
But what's measuring it? That's my question.
Well, so
what are you using to actually?
Well, since you could actually show the effects on the other organisms,
so they were looking at it under microscopes, and they were seeing that there was more cell division when they were lined up a certain way.
Right? Yeah, that was how it first.
That's how they measured it.
That's
was
first
cell division.
How they kind of got into this.
But today, like, if you were going to measure, let's say, my light energy, what would you be using?
By the time World War II came around, this was in the 40s and in the 50s, photomultipliers started to become developed and used, and they could monitor much more specifically. These photomultipliers, it's just like it sounds. It takes a photon and multiplies it. But just to give you an idea of the intensity of a photon, these aren't visible to the naked eye, and you can imagine, like, looking at a candle about 15 miles away. That's about equivalent of the intensity of a photon.
So, a single photon.
Yeah. So if you want to be able to confirm that it's coming off, you need to multiply the signal, and that's what these photomultipliers are for. And they're becoming very sophisticated. I mean, there's chambers that you can measure whole body emissions from humans, smaller ones that you can measure all kinds of cell cultures to plants. You want to measure the emissions coming off an orange after you pick it. You can kind of watch how that leaks out, so to speak.
So it's pretty much just a little light sensor hooked up to something that can amplify that information.
It can actually tell you the wavelengths. So, I mean, coming off of living things, you get into a little bit of the ultraviolet and a little bit into the infrared, but predominantly all the biophotons emitting from living things is all in the visible light spectrum. Like, you know, what we think of when we see a rainbow, for example. I think the take-home message from these measurements in general is just there's no question about it. We absorb and emit photons all the time, and this is coursing through our bodies. It's affected by a number of conditions that we can monitor by how it affects biophoton emission patterns. You know, you can only sweep those sorts of measurements or observations under the rug for so long until it demands you kind of update your models on what's really happening in the setting of a living system.
It's dreams of love, immigration, and a more perfect union. Jesse Colin Young speaks of a 1960s song about getting together in peace. Haitian-American songstress Layla McCalla talks about her dreams discovering Creole New Orleans, plus songs from the Everly Brothers, John Prine, and Mavis Staples. It's Dreamers, Then and Now, on American Roots from PRX.
Wednesday, September 11th, from 7 to 9 p.m. on KKFI.
The Water Sense Hotel Challenge on this current cast.
Hotels and other lodging businesses account for about 15% of the water used in commercial and institutional facilities around the country.
That's Tara O'Hare of the Environmental Protection Agency. To help hotels conserve, the EPA launched the WaterSense Hotel Challenge, a program that provides best management practices and tools. Some of the recommended techniques include checking the facility for leaks, using drought-resistant landscaping, establishing a towel and linen reuse program, and upgrading shower heads, faucets, and toilets to WaterSense-labeled fixtures. The result is a win all around. By greening their practices, hotels will save green on their water bills. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Tell your smart speaker, play KKFI, and enjoy the programming you love. KKFI, wherever you are.
So a living thing then gets its photons from where? Where are the different sources for absorbing photons, light energy?
Well, you mentioned already, plants do this the best probably. Just plant them in a little soil, you know, give them some water. You know, all living things on our planet are water-based. They can generate huge force with that. They can push through the sidewalk or your foundation. But then we have to eat other living things to survive because that's our most reliable to siphon off the light to get into our bodies. And there's the whole central energy pathway is completely outlined on how this happens. I know ATP gets the big star at the end of the line, but we're siphoning off the electron energy with every turn of what we call our energy powerhouse in our cells, which is the mitochondria, if people know about that, but that's where it happens. So we eat the food. It gets basically siphoned into the mitochondria that is kind of like a little cyclone in our cells. We siphon off the quote-unquote electron energy. Now, I mentioned that because we don't burn up the electrons. The electrons stay whole, but we just siphon off the energy carried by that.
Because they're in an excited state. They're charged.
Yeah, because they're animated by light, and that's where the force is that the plants then can deliver us when we eat the plants. Again, our most reliable way, I mean, we do absorb some straight through our skin and stuff, and we help transfer and make vitamin D, and that provides a lot of power and force that we draw from in our bodies. But
that creation of vitamin D is basically just a chemical reaction that results from photons making that reaction happen directly rather than us depending on glucose through the typical digestion system that we think of most reactions as happening from. It's just something we happen to have observed that light does to us, but there's probably...
Yeah, I mean, we just need to make more and more measurements, you know, but we're at a stage where we can do that. The closer you get to eating the thing you're choosing to eat to sustain yourself, the closer that thing is to being alive, the more light that's going to be present in there. And, you know, like, so I bought some raspberries yesterday on sale at the store. And, again, I prefer organic, but they're totally
cheap.
Fresh.
You could afford them.
Yeah. So I think everybody can appreciate if you don't eat those raspberries within a few days, you missed your opportunity. And now you can't get any sustainable light off of them anymore. So, I mean, once you pick the thing, the timer's set, and you've got to somehow get that into you as quickly as possible so that those electrons are as activated in as high energy as possible.
And that can be measured. So you can measure a fresh raspberry and a two-week-old raspberry.
Yeah, so that's interestingly, that's one of the major applications of biophoton research is you can actually, you can clearly distinguish between, like, for example, a conventionally grown food versus an organic one, just on the emission patterns that you can measure. But again, you can just measure until all the light drains out, so you kind of know, you know, how much time you actually have.
So you're saying that a piece of food, an apple that's been grown in on a tree in a pretty living system, you know, pretty organic biological, that's different than one that, say, was grown on a conventional farm, maybe kept for a while in refrigeration or kept in some kind of tank of gases that keep it from rotting, and was pumped full of chemicals when it was alive, when it was on the tree. So they're giving off different amounts of light.
You know, there's one of the ways food quality is measured is with a induced emission pattern. So you can basically flash the given thing in question and then watch how the light is re-emitted from the thing. The organic food typically will have a much slower and more sustained light emission than the ones that happen to have more impurities. And that has implications for us, too, because, you know, we live in kind of a toxic world, and we just need to be conscientious of this, because the more toxins we get in our bodies, the more it disrupts the integrity of that system, and we can't hold on to the light as well.
And really, by light, we could easily just replace that with photon, but we could also replace that with energy. Our energy is dissipated. Where's the energy coming from? It's ultimately coming from light.
Yeah, so this all comes back down to the light. I mean, yeah, that's what the energy is we're talking about.
Right, right. You know, energy tends to, whether it's fossil fuel energy or whether it's, you know, even wind energy or electrical energy, it's basically the source of that is something that came from the sun, you know.
So I get my food from a community-supported agriculture group, so it's picked the day I pick it up, usually, and it's pretty robust. I mean, everybody's heard of empty calories, right? So, I mean, we've got a whole epidemic of diabetes, obesity, a lot of medical problems that seem to affect how people are accumulating energy stored in their structure. So going back to the concept of empty calories, typically these are going to be your foods that have been more processed. The process of processing things, things can look pretty on the shelf for a long time, but basically, you just process the light right out of it. So basically, you need to eat a lot more bulk of that thing to get the light that's really sustaining you. So if people rely more on empty calories to sustain themselves, they're going to have to eat a lot more calories to be able to get the energy they need or the light stored in those things. And diabetes is a problem with how we can get the energy through our mitochondria or our energy powerhouse, and it gets kind of clogged up. And the effects of that is everything starts to break down. And if you read about the health implications of having diabetes where you can't get the energy back into a usable form that you can store in your structure, I mean, all your structure just starts to break down and your blood vessels don't hold together as well. You start to get neuropathy because, you know, your nervous systems don't function as well.
So you can get
sores, your skin breaks down.
You can get your protein shake or some kind of a powdered food substance of some kind, and it's got a certain amount of carbohydrates and a certain amount of protein, a certain amount of fat, and it's supposedly the same as maybe a meal of fresh fruits and vegetables and fresh foods. And you compare those two, and there's same volume of sugars and carbohydrates, you know, protein, fat, and in each one. And then the thing that's different, though, is what you're saying is that there's not as much energy and light energy in particular in that dried up food. So like astronauts, for example, just look wrecked, you know, and they talk about the pressure, and I'm sure there's various other tons of different things acting on them. But I wonder, you know, what else is going on if you're just depending on some kind of a ultra-processed, you know,
sure,
chemical stew rather than fresh
And this is being looked at by a lot of research teams, especially in the nutritional world. You know, Kansas City is kind of in a special place right now because we've got the USDA coming. You know, my hope is you'll have on all the packaging when you go to the store, serving size, you'll have the calorie count, but then you'll have the photon density rating on there. So then you can know how full or empty the calories you're choosing to eat actually are.
And now is anybody looking into labeling anything with that these days?
That's interesting you bring that up. You know, I haven't seen it on any food labels at all. I mean, it's just been in the research setting with food quality, you know, trying to just make some sense out of all of this. I have had the honor to be working with BKS Artisan Ales in Brookside here in town. I don't know if anybody saw the beer issue in 435 magazine, but they got beer of the year here in the local area.
BKS Brewery.
But anyway, they were kind of interested in this concept because they clearly feel like they make a product different than other breweries, and they were wondering if it was some influence they bring to the beers as they make it. And so we proposed that we measure the photon density and how the emission patterns are different than, you know, like your more conventional beer or even other microbrewed or artisanal beers. But so actually they wanted to name that beer Photon Density, and we've had some fun with that. But that's the first commercially available product I know of that has the photon density rating on the label.
And so they've measured the photon density of this beer that they brewed, which they feel like has a high level.
Well,
and now, so it's called Photon Density. Are they bottling this yet?
Yeah, so we've had one batch that came out in July. Our second batch is actually coming out this Friday at 4 p.m.
Oh, wow, this Friday. So that's going to be Friday the
13th.
Oh, my goodness.
That's batch number two. Our first batch, we only had 68 four-packs, and it sold out in 30 minutes.
So where could people find this substance?
Just at the brewery itself.
Oh, BKS Brewery, okay.
63rd and Holmes Road. I don't know, that's just kind of a fun little side
project. Yeah,
I'm hoping to take that to the USDA, just because they need to bring this into their understanding of what's going on too, because there's so many studies of nutrition that compare eating fresh whole foods versus ultra processed foods and the differences that the individuals require. You know, keeping everything else consistent, they do have to eat more.
Yeah, you know,
higher calories.
This summer I did a project with students and I had like 50 different diet books, and out of all these diet books, every single one of them, the only thing they had in common, they're all different sorts of crazy ideas or great ideas that were always arriving at the same solution, which is fresh fruits and vegetables. There wasn't a single diet book that says those are not a good idea. But we need to recognize how to track that, how to keep track of that, and how to maximize that, it sounds like.
So many variables can affect that. I mean, from, you know, all of our agricultural practices, how we produce the given thing, what we expose the given foods to, how we process it, how we store it, how we prepare it. And again, the time is just to bring those sorts of measurements into the equation, because I mean, we'll never figure it out if we don't just start measuring everything in, you know, all the different conditions that go into what ultimately make it to our plates and what we end up ingesting. It's exciting work. And also another fun thing about it is the Bioagricultural Defense Center is opening up at K-State, which has been a big agricultural research center. But they're...
Yeah, huge their facility they're making that thing.
They're charged to protect all of our agriculture from all sorts of things. And if we're, you know, clearly some things are changing in our environment that we need to be aware of, all the different variables that go into all of our agricultural practices and how that ultimately affects us and our sustainability that depends on that, because we can't sustain ourselves if we don't have a way to reliably get light into our systems.
So it makes me wonder if, I mean, if we want to be the, you know, a healthy country, the strongest country, you know, have a leg up, maybe one thing we need to look into is how to best maximize our food system for ourselves, look at it positively rather than threats. Look at what we can do for ourselves and the threat of just lack of knowledge, because currently that's what it sounds like is happening. We don't understand enough about this, and we're not maximizing what we're getting out of the thing that's sustaining us.
Yeah. Okay, so this is another interesting thing. Let's just take bioterrorism, for example. There's enough natural environmental changes going on, but what if somebody actually tried to decimate our food supply? Being able to monitor the photon, you know, the biophoton emissions, we can at least pick up things in a way more less invasive way and probably at a more subtle level than our current methods, so that we can begin to recognize what it is that we're even trying to protect ourselves from as far as threats are concerned. You know, 'cause as soon as some influence affects our food supply, we need to know about that as soon as possible.
Yeah.
So if this is still the most subtle and the most sensitive way to measure and monitor the integrity of a living system.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. It's the end of summer, and across the U.S., high school football players are hitting the field for practice. But running drills and heavy pads can be dangerous on hot days. And the risks are growing as the climate warms. Andrew Grunstein of the University of Georgia studies the threat. He says heat stroke can be deadly, so staff must be trained to recognize the symptoms and respond quickly. Coaches can also help prevent an emergency in the first place.
Although the conditions are getting hotter, there's a lot of different things that we can do to protect our players.
For example, making the first few weeks of practice less strenuous.
Over time, your body becomes better at handling the heat, so you don't start with the most intense practice or conditioning drills. You ease into it. For instance, you wouldn't have them wear full pads and equipment if they're football players the first couple of days.
And when the temperature spikes, coaches can limit time outside or schedule practice for a cooler part of the day. Grunstein says these precautions can help young athletes stay safe as the climate warms.
You don't need to stop sports because of this. I just think you need to be more cognizant or aware of the problem so that you can set up good safety policies.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Hey, it's Junebug. Please join me and all the Blues Kitcheners and Kitchenettes at our 20-year anniversary celebration of the Blues Kitchen. We will gather for a night of frivolity at Knuckleheads on Saturday, September 28th for five bands, including Freedom Affair, Turkey Bone and Full Count, Junebug and the Porchlights, Katie Guillen and Stephanie Williams, and our headliner, Damon Fowler. Get your tickets now at knuckleheadskc.com and your info at kkfi.org. Come party with the cool cats and the hot chicks, digging the good vibes, on Saturday, September 28th. We'll see you there.
Bought a home and a room full of strangers.
Ebony's Bones is a kitchen table conversation that explores the souls of black folk as we decolonize and question everything that we've been told to believe. Tune in Thursday, September 12th at 7 p.m. and have a seat at the table.
So there's all this light coursing around us. The Earth gets impacted with all this light. According to stuff that I've read and been taught, the plant life on Earth at an ideal situation absorbs about 10% of that light, and 90% of that is just given off as heat and reflected back into space, and doesn't do much for us. And it's also the heat that gets trapped by carbon and the other big molecules that, you know, that we have in our atmosphere. But so that's something that we're also just really lacking utility of, is how much we could be maximizing that energy, and how that is a vital way to keep ourselves alive, you know. And it's so much energy, so much potentially charged electrons, which we love for our electricity, and we love for just our own personal vitality, you know, how we live, how we get stuff out of our food. So maximizing that's really what it's about, figuring out how we can use all that energy.
There's a principle that living things live in a coherent way, so that all the elements in the system are kind of aware of every other element, and it's just bringing a much more holistic view to things that makes them different than non-living things.
Yeah, because I mean, one of the things that we talk about, or I think about a lot with understanding cells, understanding what's going on in our bodies, is that there's way more than just the sugar breaking as an energy source, and there's also way more happening that's making things line up, making things work together. If you look at how much needs to line up for the DNA to express itself, it's absurd.
It's a very exciting time because a lot of research has been done in these areas. And again, there's some observations that just don't fit our models right now. Like, for example, in the nervous system, we can clearly show you can get a signal from point A to point B faster than our models can support a message going that fast. Now, some research teams just in the recent few years have clearly shown that photon streams can travel through our microtubule systems, and they run the entire course. You know, these are some of the longest cells we have, sometimes multiple feet long.
Yeah, 4 feet long. Yeah.
And they've got these microtubules coursing the entire distance of that. All the water is in phase with each other. Once you have everything in phase like that, then the electrons can be shared amongst the continuum.
Oh, wow. So the electrons are just bumping the energy from one water to
And that's one of the things about quantum mechanics. You can learn the momentum, but you can't know the position because, you know, it kind of just connects the particle wave theory of reality, which we definitely live in. And, I mean, that's been shown for decades that's a reality that we just have to get our heads around. But once you have a setup where you have a tubular structure where all the water is in phase with each other, you've got coherence amongst all the elements of your entire nervous system, and you've got these photons coursing through all of that, you can have speed of light fast signals going all over the place.
Yeah.
This is like demanding our models be updated a little bit because the research teams are already showing, we're getting observations that clearly don't fit the models we currently have to describe how this happens. Again, it's there, and it just needs to be embraced by some people in power.
So it seems like there's a whole lot of potential for kind of integrating a more holistic view of physics and nature and medicine and the environment. And I think it's putting a lot of these things together in a scientific way. And so this is really compelling to me for that reason.
And it does bring, again, elaboration to a model that it starts to explain a lot of things that have kind of fallen outside of our ability to just describe them in the medical world. So, I mean, I'm trained and educated in a lot of the complementary and alternative therapies, and I clearly work with people with complex problems, and they may have already exhausted all their conventional options they can get through, you know, a hospital or, you know, their regular doctor. And so I often will kind of help guide them through choices that they may want to turn to that kind of fall outside of what you can traditionally learn in a medical school setting. But, you know, we've heard of, like, just mindfulness, you know, meditation, non-local phenomenon where a practitioner will just, by not even touching the person, will, you know, claim to influence the biochemistry or the health and vitality of the individual receiving the treatment. You know, as we've measured different parts of the anatomy, the hands have the highest density of light emissions coming from the palms of the hand. I mean, like the forehead does, the chest, you know, all parts of the body technically do, but the hands are a very strong place for the light to come out of somebody. So they've done studies on non-local phenomenon where people are isolated but directing energy in a mindful way on a recipient, and you can actually see the changes in the biophoton emission patterns from the person receiving the treatment. So this is just opening the door to how we can begin to assess some of these things that haven't found it easy to get into the traditional medical model.
These energy pathways people talk about in Chinese medicine too, it kind of reminds me of that. Acupuncture and how similar a bunch of acupuncture needles look when they're lined up on somebody to electrical wires. You know, you've got these electrical poles, and instead of the wire being above the surface, it's below the surface, though. So you're tapping into these different currents.
You know, this is one of the most fascinating things, and I was introduced to this when I was out at the International Institute of Biophysics in Germany. They were using nanoparticles, and they would inject them into the acupuncture meridians or the acupuncture points. And sure enough, as they followed the course of these nanoparticles, they would definitely get into streams. You know, looking at the histology of that, you wouldn't have been able to recognize there were rudimentary structures that could carry these flows of charge. But with the nanoparticles kind of illuminating then where those were going, they were able to dissect tubular structures out of that where you wouldn't be able to recognize it from the histology otherwise.
But these are also referred to as meridians in
that. Well, so that was practice. The connection of that. And along there are these things called the Bonghan corpuscles. They're Bonghan ducts is what they're called. But I mean, there's hundreds of studies on this out there now. But they were able to see these little corpuscles along the lines of flow that they were clearly able to show there's RNA in those. So they've got some regenerative capacity or some sort of signaling capacity as the current potentially encounters those sorts of structures. But again, this is just, you know, we haven't had the ability to use nanoparticles for very long in medical research, but it's starting to show at least how these current flows go. So much is dependent on the bioelectric nature of things and bioelectromagnetic nature, and it just brings so much more clarity to how things happen. I mean, it's not just a bunch of random billiard balls in our cells just randomly bumping into each other to make what we do reality. It's so much more sophisticated than that. But the nature of those patterns of emission, though, clearly bring to understanding that there's this coherence idea, because in the induced emission patterns, it'll decrease in a parabolic way, so it'll kind of like dip at the end, but then it'll just like continue on for so long. It's just a more linear pattern if you just shine a light on something, like a piece of dead inanimate material. It just can't hold on to it in a laser-like sort of way where you can just sustain the emissions just out for almost indefinitely.
through the right pathway, if you've got the pathways lined up and you've got the
Well, if you've got the coherence there. But you can't, unless you have this kind of background, integrated, holistic nature of all the photons interacting in a field sort of way.
Like you'd find a living thing.
Yeah. Then you can't get an emission pattern like that. Where it just
like on a dead
preserved. It'll just be like it'll just dissipate like linearly and not in this hyperbolic way. Because with the hyperbolic way, I mean, this is getting into some high tech stuff, but you've just got a conservation or a preservation of the light in the structure, just because the structure can only maintain itself if it has that capacity, right?
You're powered by light, folks. Don't forget it. It's pretty awesome.
In my study and practice, one thing is clear, that yes, you need the light to animate your pieces, but the pieces are absolutely required. You know, we've done a lot of that research over the last 100 years too, where we all know there's some essential nutrients we just have to have. You know, these aren't just vitamins and minerals, but also amino acids, fatty acids, you know, some of which are completely essential. If we don't have them in our midst or in our space and our structure, things aren't just going to go, they just won't go well for us. So you have to have all the pieces required to then be able to hold on to the light, but then you've got to work on animating all those pieces. But again, you're not going to be able to fill yourself in if you don't have all the pieces required. So I'm definitely a big component of making sure all the basic elements are accounted for, and I help to clarify that for people so that then they can maximize the light that they can store and maintain in their structure, so they can maintain their vitality and viability for the longest amount of time.
And to fight off disease and to protect yourself.
And do everything your body needs to do.
Yeah, deal with immunity. And
deal with whatever comes to you through the environment that we're just inundated by, that we have to have a response ability, or, you know, the ability to respond to just maintain our sustainability. We have to process out all kinds of inputs, from things that come to us psychosocially through relationships to chemicals from the environment, whether they be natural or man-made. You know, we know it's not good to eat a bunch of mercury, but mercury is pretty natural. You know, there's a lot of stuff we just have to protect ourselves from even, you know, just the foods that we have to process and run our metabolism. But we need a power source to be able to do all that. And the light really does provide the majority of that.
And thanks to Dr. Sullivan for teaching us some enlightening things about the way that light impacts our bodies and our cells in particular. This is kind of a new paradigm-shifting way of looking at things. And if you'd like to find out more, I would recommend, or I would suggest that there's an article by Marco Bischoff, which is named the same title as our program today, Light in Our Cells. And he's a German scientist who can teach you more about that. So you can Google that topic also. If you just Google biophotons or some different topics related to that, such as there's light therapies and also biophysical impact of light, some things to look into. Really fascinating stuff. And things that I hope that we pursue more in the future, using that to kind of track and understand what are we getting out of our foods and what are we getting out of our environment and what's coming out of our bodies. So new ways of looking at light and energy. And we have just a little announcement I want to give you guys about this great event that's happening. It's actually sold out, the Climate Action Summit happening down at Johnson County Community College on September 14th. But Saturday at 4 o'clock, you can go see the speaker, Paul Hawken, for free there down at Yardley Hall in the Carlson Center at College Boulevard and Quivira in Overland Park. Paul Hawken is a former guest of Eco Radio. He was on the air a couple weeks ago, and he's a great environmental steward and educator and author. And he's had some great success in business, ecologically conscious businesses, and he's an excellent writer. And he's founded the Project Drawdown, which is a nonprofit dedicated to researching when and how global warming can be reversed. And it's happening right now. Lots of people doing things for that. So something to check out down this Saturday at 4 o'clock. We can fill that Yardley Hall at the Carlson Center. Stay tuned for more great programming on KKFI with Fiesta Musical coming up in just about 9 minutes. Thanks for tuning in, everybody.
Events for the week of 9-9. On Tuesday, September 10th, 7 to 8:30 p.m., author George Frazier will discuss his book, The Last Wild Places of Kansas, Journeys into Hidden Landscapes, at the Topeka Group of the Sierra Club, which meets at Unitarian Fellowship. Contact Duncan Whittier at 785-249-3976. Also Tuesday, September 10th, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m., meeting of the Kansas Group of the Sierra Club. Program will be the Green New Deal. Kiana Harris, hub trainer for the Sunrise Movement, Kansas City, will present. Contact Dan Wancura at 913-268-7483. Everyone is welcome. On Saturday, September 14th at 1 p.m., there'll be a monarch butterfly tagging event at Burr Oak Woods Conservation Center. 1401 Northwest Park Road, Blue Springs, Missouri. All ages, no registration, no cost. Call 816-228-3766. Also on Saturday, September 14th at 1 p.m., Pick and Paw Paws at Burr Oak Woods Conservation Center, Blue Springs, Missouri. Adults only, registration required. Again, call 816-228-3766. On Saturday, September 14th, is the Metro KC Action Summit. Check our webpage for information on how to go to the free public event Saturday, 2:30 to 5 p.m. at Johnson County Junior College. Saturday, September 14th, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., is the second annual Lawrence Electric Vehicle Showcase in the parking lot of Hy-Vee Grocery, 3504 Clinton Parkway. Rain date the same time on Sunday, September 15th. September 14th, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., the Fall Family Festival will be at the Beanstalk Children's Garden, Kansas City Community Gardens, 6917 Kensington Avenue, Kansas City, Missouri. Activities include garden crafts, face painting, horse rides, bug events, gourd painting, and more. The event is free to the public, and food and drink will be available for purchase. On Sunday, September 15th, Cultivate KC Dig-In is at the Kansas City Farmers Market. Tickets are required. Go to cultivatekc.org. These items and more can be found on our Eco Radio KC program page at www.kkfi.org and on our Eco Radio KC Facebook page. Please stay tuned after our show for Fiesta Music Hall.
The feds plan to rip out trees in a national monument. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Hurricane Dorian hit Nova Scotia on Saturday after moving up the southeast coast of the U.S. The monster storm caused its worst damage in the Bahamas, killing 44 as of this newscast.
In addition to damaging about 90% of homes and buildings on Grand Abaco Island, the storm blew the tops off of six tanks on Grand Bahama Island, causing crude oil to spill and threaten coastal ecosystems.
The people on the island get their water from aquifers, which could be contaminated, affecting the drinking supply for survivors.
The oil could also have a major impact on corals and marine life, which is a source of food and income. The Norwegian company that owns the facility said that cleanup efforts would begin as soon as possible.
The Federal Bureau of Land Management is planning to remove an unprecedented number of trees in the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument in southern Utah.
The government says the removal of pinyon and juniper, some of it by clear-cutting, will reduce fire risk, improve habitat for the greater sage-grouse, and increase forage for cattle and deer, all in a process it calls vegetation treatments.
Environmental groups are appealing the plans. The government says the pinyon-juniper are encroaching on areas they don't belong. But according to the Grand Canyon Trust, studies have shown that juniper has been the dominant species for 7,000 years.
National Geographic reports the BLM will use various methods to remove the trees, including bulldozers to drag a chain that upends everything in its path. Cultural artifacts and fossils are also threatened. Even the government says it will irreparably harm the landscape.
Carolyn Shelton, a former assistant manager of the monument, said that it is home to the second highest diversity of bee species in North America.
The pinyon juniper forests are the most common but least understood in the Southwest. In December, President Trump issued an executive order to increase logging in forests and to manage rangelands in order to curb wildfires, all with limited environmental review and public input.
The tree removal program in the Grand Staircase is part of a much larger effort to clear-cut tens of thousands of acres across the Colorado Plateau, the Great Basin, and into the Pacific Northwest.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has identified a massive triangular area of warm water in the Pacific Ocean, stretching from Alaska to Hawaii and Southern California.
The new warm water could rival the so-called blob that appeared in 2014 and continued for 2 years, wreaking havoc on West Coast ecosystems.
That blob created algal blooms that shut down crabbing and clamming, stranded sea lions on beaches, and reduced food for salmon. It forced whales to feed closer to the shore where they could get caught in fishing gear.
Marine heat waves occur when the surface temperature of the water is 90% warmer than past measurements for 5 days in a row.
The current phenomenon appears to be caused by a ridge of high pressure that dampened the winds that otherwise mix and cool the ocean's surface. This heat wave is primarily affecting the upper layers of the ocean, and NOAA says it could break up rapidly. The Columbia River system in the Northwest is the fourth largest in North America and drains an area the size of France.
The Bonneville Power Administration, the agency responsible for generating and transmitting hydropower along the Columbia, faces two challenges: a changing market for electricity and an inability to protect salmon and steelhead.
Bonneville is in serious financial trouble. E&E News reports that it's buckling under $15 billion in debt and faces an energy market increasingly dominated by wind and solar.
Additionally, Bonneville has paid almost $17 billion to mitigate the effects of its dams on threatened and endangered salmon and steelhead, the cost of which is passed on to customers. However, fish recovery efforts have not been working as runs continue to decline.
With its ability to borrow money floundering, Bonneville may not be able to afford fish protection programs. Some have been arguing to remove four dams on the system in order to increase salmon and steelhead numbers.
The political will to do something about Bonneville may be growing. Earlier this year, Mike Simpson, a Republican representative from Idaho, said that the fish and power problems are connected. Although he did not call for the removal of dams, E&E reports that his speech sent a tsunami through the political, environmental, and energy communities.
And finally, ever heard of duckweed? If researchers at Rutgers University have their way, it soon may become a household name.
Duckweed is a tiny aquatic plant grown all over the globe, and a lab at Rutgers houses the world's largest collection of the species.
The scientists think duckweed is, well, just ducky. It could be the next superfood, power our cars, or help to treat disease.
Duckweed is the world's fastest growing plant. It has more protein than soybeans and is a good source of minerals and vitamins. Given that climate change is expected to threaten the world's food supply, duckweed might be able to help feed Earth's population, projected to hit 9.7 billion in 2050.
In sequencing the DNA of one of the 37 species of duckweed, the researchers discovered that its immune system protects it against a wide range of harmful microbes and pests, including fungi and bacteria.
That opens the door to using duckweed not only for developing drugs, but also treating wastewater.
The scientists also hope that in the future, duckweed strains could be used to recycle waste into biofuels to power cars and generate electricity.
Duckweed's sustainable because it can be grown hydroponically in urban areas, which means grabbing less